Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 94-year-old veteran tells us how he earned the Silver Star and Purple Heart and also about the future president he served with.
He wore boots, breeches, and a campaign hat, the only officer on the post that did, and we called him Cowboy, and that was Ronald Reagan.
Don't miss Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ. Whether you hear us on the AM side at 580 at 1 o'clock or on our FM station 105.9 at 5 p.m., maybe even online anywhere around the world, anytime at kmjnow.com. What you know is that this show is about honoring our veterans. It's about making them know that we appreciate their service and their sacrifice, that what they've done will not be forgotten. We can learn along the way, too, and I know we're going to do that today with a story that has a quite recent twist I think you'll really enjoy hearing about. I'm going to visit today with 94-year-old Ed Farmer of Spokane Valley, Washington, but a guy who spent a lot of his life in California and quite a few years in Hawaii before Pearl Harbor. But you grew up originally...
All over
the place.
I left Maine in very early 36.
And in 36 is when you joined the military. What made you decide to do that in 1936?
I was hungry. It was three meals a day, a bed and food, clothing. I got $20 a month cash, which was a lot of money in those days.
Coming out of the Depression, that was a whole lot of money. So you joined the Army, and then it got better. They sent you to Hawaii.
When I joined, I said I wanted to be sent to Hawaii, mm-hmm. And that's what they did.
Which is pretty rare to actually get to go where you wanted to go. So you must have been doing something right. And, you know, most people that I interview, when they heard about the attacks on December 7th, 1941, it was the first they had ever heard of a place called Pearl Harbor. But I guess you got to know it pretty well. What was the island of Oahu like when you got there in 1936?
Absolute paradise. There were three hotels on Waikiki Beach. The old Moana, which was built back in the 1800s, Waikiki Hotel, which was Hawaiian most famous at that time, and the very small hotel on the beach. That was it, three.
And you had plenty of military folks around, and you ended up at Schofield Barracks, and there are a lot of famous people that you served with. At this time, there was a young guy named Patton running around there somewhere with a tank?
George S. Patton, Major, commanding the tank unit at Schofield Barracks. He was mean, rotten, and nasty in those days. And as he got older, I want to tell you something, he got worse. Because the next time I met him at Fort Benning, Georgia, he was a Major General commanding the Armored Division at Fort Benning. And there I found that he was really meaner than he ever was at Schofield.
So you wouldn't take any issue with that old blood and guts nickname. You think that's pretty apropos, huh?
That would be fitting right to a T.
What else did you experience besides getting on his bad side or getting a taste of his vinegar? For the years that you spent there in Hawaii, what kinds of things did the Army have you doing, and what was life like?
We had a daily training. Saturdays and Sundays were usually... Saturday was inspection day, Sunday was the day off. We did this through the years until June 17th, 1940, when the bugle rang out and it was call to arms. And we had to go get all our weapons out of the supply room. And we had 30 minutes to clear the barracks and go out into the field. It seemed that we were supposed to be being attacked by the Japanese at that time. Now I want you to stop and think. This is June 1940. This was a year and a half before the actual attack. Every maneuver and everything that we did back in those days was always called code yellow. Guess why?
Because of the color of their skin?
We used to refer to them as the little yellow people. But I know that probably 99% of the people in the United States had no idea that that happened. We stayed in the field off and on, digging trenches, emplacements all over the island from that time on. And nobody that was stationed there yet can figure out why the alert was called off Friday, the day, 2 days before the attack. I remained in Hawaii until July 1941, when I, and as generally short, referred to us. He was the new commanding general. I'm getting rid of all you damn homesteaders. And away we went. A whole bunch of us got kicked out at that time.
Because you'd been on the island for 5 years practically.
And so I know the facts of what happened very well at Pearl Harbor, because when I get sent back to the States, I was assigned to an MP company at Fort Mason, California. And I happened to be, at that time, I was made the provost sergeant major of the post. Our only duty as an MP company at that time was to go out and meet all convoys and trains coming in loaded with material that was going overseas to be loaded out of the ships in San Francisco at that time. I also was very fortunate to have the experience of having a new second lieutenant assigned to Fort Mason in October of 41, who was a cavalry officer, and he wore boots, breeches, and a campaign hat. The only officer on the post that did, and we called him Cowboy, and that was Ronald Reagan. So I served with him for 4 months as enlisted, and in 42, when I became commissioned, we were second lieutenants at the same time together. We attended the officers' club at Fort Mason together as officers. It was quite an experience, too. At that time, he was pretty nondescript, really, as an actor at that time. I think he had one famous movie that he played in called, I think it was called The King's Men. And all the others, he was a cowboy in the odors that they used to make in those days.
Right.
He and Hoop Gibson and all those people like that, Tom X.
And he had he'd done some baseball announcing before that. But so did you know who he was as an actor, or was it news to you when you found out that's what he did?
We found out that he was an actor, but the thing was that he was married to Jane Wyman, which most of us knew.
You knew who Jane Wyman was.
We knew who Jane Wyman was. We didn't really know who he was until he came to the Post. And we just loved having him on the Post because all these actresses used to come and visit him all the time. Olivia de Havilland and his sister Joan Fontaine and Betty Grable, all of the famous ones used to happen to just come by and visit him while. So it was really great having that guy on the Post, believe me.
I hear what you're saying. And I guess I've got to ask you, since, of course, now in retrospect, we know what happened with the rest of Ronald Reagan's life. Did you look at this man, this second lieutenant, and say, hey, there's a future president of the United States?
No, I don't think I would have at that time. He was just a down-to-earth, well, let's say cowboy. That's really how I can explain him. A real wonderful, personable individual. A real nice guy.
And we'll come back to that, but let's focus on Ed Farmer a little bit. Because here you'd been in Hawaii for 5 years. You get transferred out of there 5 months before the Japanese attack, even though you had drilled for attacks and practiced that eventuality. And from the way you described it, it kind of sounds like you guys were practicing for the possibility that Japan might try to invade Hawaii, not just raid it with bombers, but actually land on the beaches?
That's what we were informed of, that situation in 40, that they were going to attack us, which meant to us they were going to land. That's why all the trenches and gun emplacements and everything were all built all around the island at that time. And it was only Oahu. It wasn't any other island that happened on.
You were in San Francisco on December 7th, 1941?
Yes, I was.
How'd you hear about it?
I was loading a troop ship at Pier 45, and they used to have these cruises going out in the bay, and the person that was running the cruise thing came out on his loudspeaker, and all of a sudden I heard, the Japanese have attacked Hawaii. They're bombing Hawaii, Honolulu, and Pearl Harbor. It stunned me. It just stunned me. I thought, year and a half, they've been waiting for it. We knew that something should happen from what they told us.
And knowing that, knowing how prepared you guys were and how you hoped they would have been prepared, were you surprised when you heard the extent of the damage that day?
Yes, I was, because I happened to know that before I left Oahu, Honolulu, that the ships were never in the harbor like that, concentrated. Never. They used to wait outside and come in two or three at a time to have their repairs or replenish their supplies and then back out. And I was stunned when I heard that the whole damn fleet was sitting there tied up in Pearl Harbor. And not only that, but at Wheeler Field, which was part of Schofield Barracks, when I was there, they had built all these revetments, and all the planes all the time were always in those revetments when they weren't actually out to go flying. And nobody can figure out why on that morning all those planes were aligned on the field at Wheeler Field, right in the line, to be wiped out by just so easy by even machine gun fire.
What kind of emotion did that stir in you when you heard the full extent of what Japan had inflicted at this place where you'd spent so much of your life, and a place that you thought would have been better prepared? What did it make you mad? Did it make you angry?
Well, yes, it made me angry, because when I found out later what they had done about the planes at Wheeler Field and about the ships all being tied up together in Pearl Harbor, I couldn't figure out where all the stupidity came from. all of a sudden. I'll put it that way because to me, and the reason I can relate so much to what happened at Pearl Harbor, because when I went back overseas in January 44, I was assigned right back to the 21st Infantry Regiment, 24th Division in New Guinea. And all the men that I had served with when I was a platoon sergeant, almost it seemed like most of them were still there and hadn't been rotated. So I got to talk to all these, and of course, I got to talk to all the officers that were there at the time of the attack. My battalion commander that I was assigned to in the 1st Battalion, 21st Infantry, I had been one of his platoon sergeants from 1940 in the part of 41 that I was there. When I went back, I was a first lieutenant, and he was a lieutenant colonel commanding the 1st Battalion, 21st Infantry. The first company I took over command of, the first sergeant and I were roommates as platoon sergeants in H Company of the 21st when I was stationed there.
Well, and maybe that kind of answers the other question I had for you. If so many of these guys did survive December 7th there, I was going to ask you if you've ever wondered what would have happened to you had you still been there on December 7th. But it sounds like you might have been okay if all of them were okay.
Probably. There were no people that I know of that were killed up at Schofield at the infantry units, even though they were up on the roof of the buildings, barracks, firing machine guns at the Japanese planes going by. There was some strafing, but they didn't recall anybody being wounded or killed in the strafings.
Well, I've got a lot more questions for you, but we need to catch a commercial break here. 94-year-old Ed Farmer of Spokane Valley, Washington is our guest today. We heard about his interactions with General Patton when he was just Major Patton back in 1936. We heard a little bit about that guy, Ronnie Reagan, who would go on to become president. And there are some others, like General MacArthur, that Ed had some interactions with as well. We'll also hear about how he earned the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart, and how his story from World War II came full circle just recently with the exchange of a prized possession. Ed Farmer, our guest today, will be back with more of Hometown Heroes after this on KMJ. Paul Leffler here with a little holiday greeting from Sleep Retreat, where you'll find the Valley's largest selection of Tempur-Pedic mattresses. I was trying to figure out what else I could tell you about the most highly recommended bed in America, so I asked one person I knew would give me a real common sense answer. I asked my wife what she appreciates most about the Tempur-Pedic we got from Sleep Retreat. "I actually sleep," she said immediately, "and my back doesn't hurt." And before I could tell her about how Tempur-Pedic's temperature and weight-sensitive material responds to your body's natural shape, she had more. "My hips don't hurt when I sleep on my side." You know what's funny? Those are exactly the kind of examples that experts like Napoleon over at Sleep Retreat will use to show you how you can be happier and healthier on a Tempur-Pedic. If you really want a story, ask them why Tempur-Pedic is the only mattress recognized by NASA, the Arthritis Foundation, and the Space Foundation. Come feel the difference for yourself at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Ed Farmer. He retired as a major after more than 20 years in the U.S. Army. He first enlisted in 1936. He said he grew up always wanting to become a soldier. That he was. He was sent from Hawaii to San Francisco just a few months before the attacks on Pearl Harbor. And you told us about how you experienced that news there in San Francisco, Ed. But after that, anybody that was already in uniform, from what I've gathered and all the interviews I've done, had a newfound urgency. At least the government had an urgency for them to get busy doing one thing or another. So what did the Army do with you after the Pearl Harbor attacks?
I left Fort Mason in February 42 and was sent to Fort Benning for 3 months, and I became a 90-day wonder, second lieutenant. at that time.
A 90-day wonder. They hurried it up because they needed infantrymen.
That's what they did. That's what they called us, 90-day wonders. But at that time, almost all the men that were going to OCS were all old soldiers like me that were highly trained in those days.
Now, most of the guys that I talk to, especially these days, were pretty young when they got in. And you, as being a little older than some of the others, did you trust these teenagers that were around you? Did you feel like an old man? Did you think you could count on these guys who were fresh out of high school?
We knew one thing. We were going to make soldiers out of them, period. And training, we gave them as rigid training as we could give them. Now, in those days, if you couldn't qualify to do that rigid training like that, they always had the quartermaster corps, where they could go carry crates and other type signal corps where they didn't have to depend on fighting to stay alive like the infantry. Infantry was very tough on all men and culled out very quickly those that were not qualified to take rigid training. And the training was, to us in those days, was very tough. But when I see the training that these kids are going through today, hell, it was a picnic. It was a picnic. Now when I compare our difficult training to what these kids go through today, I admire these kids today. I'm very proud of our military personnel, and I wish we could keep the politics out of the military. That's what ruins, to me, the military.
I think there are a lot of veterans listening right now and nodding their heads in agreement with you. And you mentioned those serving in our armed forces today, and the thing they have in common with you is that they've all volunteered to serve our country as you did. So you end up going overseas with the 24th Infantry Division, the 21st Regiment. Where was your first taste of combat? Was that in New Guinea? Uh-huh. Tell me about that. What do you remember about that first experience?
We landed at Hollandia, New Guinea. We thought we'd seen some swamp on this island that we trained on. Good enough island it was called. I don't know what it was good enough for, but that was the name of the island. But there was so much swamp to go through and to fight through. But it stayed that way. All jungle is the same over there, no matter where you go. The Philippines, the jungle, it seemed to rain every day. The main fighting didn't last very long in New Guinea because where we were, the 24th Division, because we captured the airfields and all in the area of Hollandia, which was our main objective, in which we could use the bomb to the Philippines and other areas. So the only thing that from the time that I hit Good Enough Island, the next permanent building I was in was in October 44. When I was wounded, I ended up, there was a church that hadn't been completely destroyed, and they were using that as a field hospital to get us through. The rest of the time was intense when we weren't actually in combat.
And when you were actually in combat, sometimes you probably had to sleep out in the rain and torrential typhoons, huh?
Every night was in the slit trench. We dug, like in the old days, in circles, and we dug slit trenches. Had to stay in your hole during the periods of darkness, because if you get up and moved around, you would probably be shot.
By your own people, probably, because they'd think you were Japanese.
Nobody moved at night. You stayed in your, regardless.
And I know you did an interview with Japanese television where you described yourself as three-quarters kamikaze. You didn't have a wife or children or anyone that you were too concerned about besides yourself. So I guess you were pretty brave and maybe somewhat foolhardy. Is that what you're trying to say? Stupid? Okay.
Stupid's a word. At times, yes.
How was that reflected? Give us an example of what you look back on now and say, man, that was really stupid.
One case was on a different island that we attacked later on in called Lubang, that there was a report that the Japanese were attacking this village and killing all the people in the village. I was at battalion headquarters at that time, and the only personnel that were around were a few clerks that I could grab and told them to get their rifles, and I always carried a Tommy gun after my experience in Leyte. And I said, let's go see what's going on. So we took off. We got in a firefight. We were fortunate. We drove the Japanese away from the village. But I had, I think, I don't know, something like 7 or 8 men. That was sort of stupid, idiotic, or whatever you want to term it. That's why I say that.
So even though it worked and you did what you wanted to do, you look back now and say, man, that was probably a good way to get ourselves killed.
Yes, stupid.
Well, and you reference what happened to you at Leyte. You reference being wounded. Tell me about the first time that you were wounded.
Up on a hill called 1525 that my battalion was ordered to take. Believe it or not, as long as we'd been in the Philippines. When we arrived back in the Philippines to fight, we only had guerrilla maps that they had drawn, and the ranges at times were off 1,000 to 2,000 yards, and Leyte was full of hills.
And this is in the fall of 1944?
This was in November of 44.
On Leyte, uh-huh.
My battalion, we went up this hill, this ridge, got up to the top of the ridge, took the ridge, and secured it. But there was always another ridge beyond that was always higher than the one you'd just taken. We dug in. By the time we got to the top of the ridge, it was time to dig in for the night. So we dug in. Now, leading up to this, this was all part of Breakneck Ridge. Leading up to this, our 3rd Battalion fighting on Breakneck Ridge got surrounded, and they were really getting the hell kicked out of them. And so the regimental commander ordered A Company, which was 1st Battalion, to go up and open up the rear so that the 3rd Battalion could pull back from that position that they were in. Well, it seems that halfway between the remainder of our battalion and the 3rd Battalion, A Company got cut off, too. And the first man killed in A Company was the company commander. Our radios in those days, if they got damp, they didn't work. If the sun was shining on them, they didn't work. They were practically useless. Every now and then you might get a message out. And that's how we found out that A Company was in such a terrible position in between the 2 battalions. And the battalion commander, he and I didn't see at that time. This was a different battalion commander. When I was a platoon sergeant, he was a 2nd lieutenant in H Company, and we didn't see eye to eye in those days. Well, he's a major and I'm a 1st lieutenant. Messenger came and said, hey, lieutenant, the major wants to talk to you down where he is. So he took me down to where the major was. The major said, that's how I found out the company commander had been killed. He said, company commander's been killed. I understand 2 of the other officers been killed. You go up and take command A Company. I said, where is A Company? His answer was, you command the company. You go find out.
Am I exaggerating to understand that that sounds like he was sending you on a suicide mission?
I often felt he would like to have gotten rid of me, yeah, because we weren't very good friends, but he didn't dare to do anything, right, as long as my old commander, Colonel Jock Clifford, was around, because Jock and I were just, was tops.
So you were friends with his boss. He wasn't going to mess with you too much.
Private spoke up and he said, Lieutenant, I'm from A Company. I know where A Company is. He said, I got out before they got completely surrounded, and I couldn't find them again, so he came back down the hill. And I said, well, you tell me where they are. And he said, sir, you may come to Commander. I'm going with you. So we took off and went up.
Just the two of you?
Yeah.
Going through the jungle, not knowing where you are and where the Japanese are.
No idea where in the hell. I knew they were out there in the grass someplace, and that was my knowledge of. But he had a pretty good memory, so we were going up there. And we did get in a firefight with some Japanese on the way and managed to get in. I got in and took command of the company, got it reorganized, and that's when I really found out how many of the officers had been killed or wounded.
Which I imagine isn't very encouraging for you and your own prospects of survival.
Well, you don't give much thought to that as you give much thought as to what the hell am I going to do. I've got to get. In those days, you depended very much on your platoon sergeants. Platoon leaders were lieutenants. Platoon sergeants were the backbone of the platoon. Believe me, the men depended wholly on them, and a lieutenant had to prove himself to be able to be above that platoon sergeant in their eyes. So I managed to get a hold of the different platoon sergeants that I could get a hold of and got them reorganized. We were to pull out and get back down from the Breakneck Ridge there where we were. We took all the dead with us, took all the seriously wounded, lightly wounded, and were going down the hill and fighting the rear guard action so that to keep everybody as safe as we could. Well, we got down to a point of safety, and here was a 2.5-ton truck sitting there. I said, any one of you turkeys know how to run that thing to get it going? And this one guy said, I can do it, Lieutenant, I'm sure. So he went down, and by gosh, he got it started. Well, we loaded all the severely wounded into the, and we had a lot of walking wounded. We started down the hill, and it was getting dusky. And I was sitting up on the right front fender of the 2.5 going down the hill. And I had taken a rifle from one of the men, and I was sitting there with the rifle. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and here was this Jap getting ready to jump on me. I gave the best practice butt stroke I'd ever practiced in my life, and it was a stump. It wasn't a man, but in the darkness, it looked just like this. And it smashed the rifle butt and everything, and even the most severely wounded in the truck started to laugh. And after that, they used to call me Stump Killer.
Well, I'm glad you got your laugh in there, because I know the way that whole situation turned out was no laughing matter. We'll get to those details when we come back with 94-year-old Ed Farmer. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Ed Farmer of Spokane Valley, Washington, spent a good chunk of his life in California, especially in the San Jose area. But when we left off, he was telling us about a situation on the island of Leyte in the Philippines in World War II, when he and one other man went into the jungle to try to find a missing company of soldiers.
But I had only one officer left from A Company when we got down. And when we went up to this new place, I still had only the one officer. Well, I was told to send a patrol out the next morning after we had arrived up there, and I sent him out, and the patrol came back, and they came without the lieutenant. They came without two of the scouts that had been killed, and a few of the other men had been wounded. And so the battalion commander, again, my buddy, said, "You go out and find them and find out what the hell's going on out there." I said, "I can send one of the platoon sergeants." He said, "Lieutenant, I'm ordering you take a patrol and go out and find out what's going on." I said, "There's no other commander in the company. I'll worry about that." So away I went and went out about 75 yards on this trail. I ran across this cross trail and I looked. And the Japanese soldiers all wore the boots that they wore had these little nubs, so you could, when you saw the tracks like that, you know, it was Japanese footprints, not ours. I sent my two scouts across the trail and said, "Just keep a view of what the hell may be coming on that trail until I come back." And so I started to walk up the trail. And I got up just a very few feet, and there was the lieutenant dead and two men with him. And I called and got the men to come and get them. Well, I was bent over, and I started to walk a little up the trail. And when I stood up, it was a whole Japanese patrol standing in front of me.
How far away?
20 feet, so. And I... We call it John Wayne'd it now. I just took my carbine and fired the round and hit the leader, the first man that was in there, which happened to be the officer in command of that patrol. Well, I killed him, and I pulled the trigger again. Nothing happened. I looked down, and my carbine had jammed. The second round was standing right up looking at me. Now, I don't know, fate, what do you call it? I looked down on the ground right next to me, and there was a Tommy gun laying there that one of the scouts that had been killed, they hadn't taken that. So I picked that up, and that Japanese patrol was still standing there, waiting for an order. A Japanese soldier never did anything until he was given an order to do it.
So they would have had plenty of time to shoot you.
So I took advantage of that. I didn't realize it so much at the time that I was glad I had a little better training than something like that. So I picked up the Tommy gun and killed the rest of the patrol. They were 8 men. Some people said, how can you remember there were 8? I know, because I used to have nightmares, and I saw every one of those Japanese faces over and over years later in my nightmare when I used to have them. I was the only one that could fire because I was on the trail and my men behind me couldn't do anything. And so here I am in a big firefight, and I suddenly realized I heard this machine gun. It was a Japanese light machine gun. These bullets zip right down, not on the trail, but just next to the trail. That's when I got off the trail and hit the ground. The next burst that came, I got hit. All my knuckles here, believe it or not, were all shot, and it almost shot my thumb off. I always carried a couple of grenades. What grenades I had, and the machine gun stopped. So I don't know how many. They usually had 4 or 5 men to a machine gun squad, but evidently I ruined the chances of using the machine gun again.
So you threw the grenades at the machine gun nest?
Yeah. They stopped firing anyway, so I know that I hit in amongst them so that they put them out of action. I then got up and got back, and 2 of my men had been wounded in the fighting, the rounds that were going off anyway from the machine gun or something. And so I knew we had to get out of there, because if that was a patrol, it was leading another group of Japanese coming down that trail. So we pulled back and went back into the battalion perimeter. Now, that night, the typhoon hit. And I want to tell you, I can tell you what a 120-mile-an-hour wind is like. And that rain, instead of coming straight down, was driving rain. And it was just like hail hitting you. We just covered up with our ponchos. We got back in our slit trenches. We just sit in our slit trenches. And when they filled with water, you still sit there because it was warmer sitting in the water with the poncho over you than it was being out in the weather.
I've got to ask you, what was going through your mind at the time? Because, I mean, I'm imagining myself in your shoes here. And sounds like you were pretty fortunate in that whole incident to not be killed, to be wounded, and not to minimize the extent of your wounds. I'm sure it was extremely painful, but to be hit in your left hand, but to still be able to walk out of there and to get out of there and to have taken out so many enemy in the process. And this is what you got the Silver Star for?
Yeah, that was saving the patrol and the battalion from being struck by a bigger unit, which it would have been at that time.
But so you get through all of that, you're pretty fortunate to be alive, and now you're out here in this horrible 100-mile-an-hour plus winds right in your face. What do you think you were thinking as you huddled up in there? Were you praying? Were you wishing you were back home? What were you doing?
Oh, man. You do pray a lot, believe me. If I get out of this, what am I going to do? Just hope, you know. There isn't a hell of a lot, really, is that you just want to try to stay as dry as you can with a poncho and a helmet. That's what you have to keep dry, and hope that you don't run out of ammo.
I know you said you were 3/4 kamikaze, but when you go through something like that, when you see so many other people die, when you see the people that you're forced to kill to ensure your own survival, did you get to the point where you were convinced you weren't going to make it? Did you ever let yourself think that? Were you afraid out there?
No, I wasn't a fatalist. I had my battalion commander, Jock Clifford, who had been my company commander, following him. You always felt, even after he wasn't with us, the same way, you're not going to be killed. I will inject one thing. The only men that I ever knew that said, I'm going to be killed, got careless, and they were killed. you never let yourself get or even think about like that. As far as I know, that's the way I felt.
You described for us your own personal fight with the Japanese there and the ordeal that you endured. But this was part of this bigger picture of Breakneck Ridge, which was a really pivotal part in that battle on the island of Leyte. So put that in perspective for us, the significance of that greater victory for the Americans there.
It was the one thing that the Japanese did not want us to win was the Battle of Leyte. They brought in two of their very best divisions to fight us in Leyte, in addition to the troops that were there that they had brought in previously. And one of them was the division that was called the Rapers of Nanking. They were really, we knew they were nasty, rotten people from what we'd read about them in China. And we fought their first Marine division, we found out later. I always, in my experience in Hawaii and all, knowing Japanese, were small, puny, spectacle, big buck teeth guys.
That was the stereotype, but you found otherwise, huh?
I found out that these Imperial troops were practically six-footers and stand there. I'm not that tall. I'm 5'9". Looking up at that's the closest I had really been face-to-face with. I had seen a lot of dead ones along the way, but they didn't look very big at that time. But these guys, when I looked at them, were monsters.
That's what you were up against. So you survived that incident. You got the Silver Star. You got a Purple Heart for that. Did it take you out of commission very long at all with the injuries to your hand?
Hospital about 5 weeks. And I was flown from the island of Leyte out to the island of Peleliu, which was being a very hard battle fought out there by the Marines on Peleliu. From Peleliu, I was flown down to Biak in the Netherlands, East Indies, where they had set up the general hospitals. My hand, I had received only bandages changed when I was in the hospital, temporary hospital in Palo in the Philippines. All this time flying down, and in the hospital, general hospital, down in Biak, before they changed the bandages again. And my hand was getting to the point of gangrenous. The colonel that was in charge of the hospital came around with his staff one morning, and I was laying there in a lot of pain and everything. I heard him say to his staff, "It looks like I'm going to have to amputate this." You talk about being a kamikaze and angry? I said to the colonel, I want to tell you something. I won't repeat the language. But I said, I came in your damn hospital with two arms. And Colonel, I better go out with two arms or I'm going to stick a .45 in your mouth and pull the trigger. He said, "Are you threatening me?" I said, "I'm telling you the truth, Colonel. I got my arm." Uh-huh. They went to work on it right away. I say again, you can be very stupid.
But you have your hand and you're still left-handed.
When I get a little mad, I can be stupid.
I'll try not to make you mad. And I hope I'm not going to make you mad at home when I say we're going to have to finish Ed Farmer's story next week because we're out of time on the show for today. So tune in again next Saturday and you'll hear a little bit about the bond Ed forged with the leader of the Filipino guerrilla troops he fought alongside, how a gift that man gave him has made it all the way back to the Philippines just in the last few months. And as you gather in the days ahead with your family, take a moment to consider what men like Ed went through in Christmases gone by and what our brave men and women in uniform today have to deal with overseas this holiday season. Keep them in your thoughts and in your prayers as we take advantage of the freedom they preserve for us by celebrating these holidays. For me and my family, I'd like to wish you a very Merry Christmas, and we'll catch the rest of Ed Farmer's story before the new year. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on KMJ.